bomb diddy bomb diddy bomb diddy bomb bomb diddy bomb diddy bomb a ding a ding ding a ding a dang dang blue moon. Blue blue moon. Blue 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 moon blue
copyright
moon,
strike. Blue moon.
Oh, okay. Hello and welcome to episode 163 of Ribbon of Memes, a film where we interrogate films, not a film, a podcast where we interrogate films previously. That's totally thrown me off my stride. I've transformed into a werewolf too early because this is the second part of our werewolf extravaganza. Luna Bonanza.
Werewolf-a-palooza.
That one. We are jumping forward. I am Nick. I'm joined as ever by Roger. And we are jumping forward 40 years from The Wolfman. Well aware that we are skipping some werewolf films. We had to cut some to make the grade. Most notably, perhaps, Curse of the Werewolf, Oliver Reed. And Company of Wolves. No, maybe that was there. That was later.
That was later. But yeah.
We are in the kind of the slight 80s werewolf boon. 1981 was one of those years where not one, not two, but I think three werewolf films came out. There was a third one that we haven't discussed today, but we're discussing that we won't discuss today. What was that called? The Howl? No, we are doing The Howling. which apparently is quite good.
Now calm down, take your tranquilizers.
Sorry, it's a full moon out there. We are instead discussing
Wolfen,
there we go.
Michael Wadley in the only feature film he directed, starring Albert Finney.
Yeah, I might give it a try. But we are looking at the other films generally higher regarded from 1981. There are plenty more later. I'm afraid we're not doing Teen Wolf in this podcast either, but we will be doing another podcast of later films. But today we are talking about 1981's The Howling and 1981's An American Werewolf in London. We'll do them in chronological order, which is
just barely.
Yeah, The Howling pips American Werewolf of London at the post. And The Howling was directed by Joe Dante.
So known at this point for Piranha, stretching the definition of known, but it has had some success. He would go on to do Gremlins, probably most
Gremlins famously. Most notably, yes. And he is of course, the Roger Corman School of Filmmaking, in that he gave him his big break, as well as our beloved John Carpenter, as well as many other directors of the era. American Werewolf is Landis, isn't it? What's his name? Mm-hmm. John Landis. They're all Johns. Was he a Corman? Certainly he, John Landis, and Joe Dante had worked together or knew each other very well, and they were sort of friends, rivals at this point. So it's very interesting they had two films out about the same subject, as often happens in Hollywood. See also Deep Impact and Armageddon.
And The Abyss and Deep Star 6 and Leviathan.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes I suspect what has happened is somebody's been shopping a script around, and various studios says, no, we won't buy that script, but we will take the basic concept, which obviously not copyrightable, and get one of our own scriptwriters to do something.
It must be something like that, mustn't it? Otherwise, it's pure coincidence.
Or just, you know, somebody at a party says, you know, this would be great. And three people hear it and say, yeah, that's great. Let's commission a film about it.
That's a nicer way of doing it rather than terrible film execs stealing ideas. The Howling. So this was based on a novel.
Loosely based.
Also called The Howling,
yes.
Presumably.
And yeah, 1977 book by Gary Brandner.
And that makes it's an 80s film, but it's very early 80s, and I think we forget that early 80s is often quite 70s-like.
Certainly, if you had said to me this was a film from the late 70s, I would see nothing to say no.
Yeah, it's not really shoulder pads and leg warmers, it's more kind of slightly long hair, and it has a similar vibe to it, to Dawn of the Dead. I think we both sort of independently felt that, which is the second of the Dead films, which was, I think that was early 70s, mid 70s, can't remember, but partly it has a similar vibe.
But it's got a very similar feel, as we'll see as we go through, about, you know, media sensationalism, and they don't care what they put on the news as long as it's going to get people excited, that kind of thing.
Yes, if it bleeds, it leads, kind of that sort of thing. And I think we had different initial reactions to the film. It'd be interesting to see how we come together after discussing it. But it starts...
Here's a thing for dating it. This comes out in the same year as Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And interesting.
And if you told me that this was 5 years earlier, I would have believed it. Just in terms of the filmmaking style and the subject matter and so on.
Yeah, and this is just a year before The Empire Strikes Back or so, something like that. I guess I would say Raiders of the Lost Ark is technically a period piece.
It's an 80s film in the way it's made. It's not a 30s film in the way it's made.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But it does help to date films a bit less if they're set in a different time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
But I take your point. It does feels more 70s than it does kind of Spielbergian 80s. Which is interesting because Joe Dante went on to become a very 80s kind of Spielbergian director with things like Gremlins, which feel like... But they always had a kind of hard edge to them in a way that some of the others... You know, Gremlins is actually quite misanthropic and quite unpleasant in places, but it's dressed up...
And that whole thing of either the parents or the main couple are divorced or estranged or somehow unhappy and will get back together, rather than being they just meet for the first time and get together. That seems to be quite an 80s element.
Yes, I agree, yes. So it starts, I found this interesting, I think you had a different reaction, but it starts with a serial killer in, I think it's New York?
I don't think it's explicitly stated, but it certainly looks like it.
Yes, and a roving female reporter who is...
She's a news anchor.
She's not a reporter. That's the important thing.
She is a news anchor who has, presumably by virtue of being on television, attracted the attention of this serial killer.
And the idea is they're going to wire her up, they're going to track him, and they're basically going to expose him live on TV.
They're going to arrest him live on TV.
This is definitely a police
operation. Not just the station.
But the payoff is, okay, but we're going to, it's going to be our story afterwards. We're going to own this story. But it's clear that they are, for the purpose of, even though it is a police operation, the undercurrent is, you know, for the purposes of ratings, we are prepared to put our anchor into a dangerous situation. And it's unclear whether she's decided, whether she's put herself forward for this or whether she was persuaded to do it. I do find one of the unfortunate things for me about The Howling is Dee Wallace, who plays Karen, I think she comes across on screen as more of a classic horror scream queen in that she doesn't, it would have been great if we had kind of a Faye Dunaway kind of feisty character here, that kind of.
I think there are bits of the script that are trying to give her that, but she doesn't quite play it. I'm not familiar offhand with her other work. The only other role that I recognise and I haven't seen it is the next year she would be the mother in E.T.
Oh, of course she was. Yeah, didn't think of that. But again, she's not by a long way from the main character in E.T. Yeah. The parents are largely ignored in E.T. That didn't quite work for me because she's... she goes into a sex shop.
Because we should just say, first of all, we start with her interviewing... Doctor, I can't remember what his character is called.
Patrick McNee. You can't think of anything else other than Patrick McNee when you say
who is basically talking about the mind of this serial killer.
But he's also doing the kind of there is a beast within. He's basically doing the whole werewolf kind of there is a beast within us, and we're all natural creatures, and we should let this beast out. He's kind of cod philosophy. The noble savage kind of all the, well, actually that's a different thing, but that kind of, the primal urge within us and all that. Again, I personally am more familiar with Patrick McNee in these kind of 80s roles because I wasn't a big Avengers watcher at the time.
Yeah, that is a problem for me because, I can't remember his dates, but I think he stayed with it till the end. So he played that basically through the 60s. And it's now 10 years later, and he has, to be fair, perfectly reasonable, he has got a bit older, he's got a bit heavier. I just find 80s Patrick McNee very difficult to watch, particularly when, and as here, he portrays a very self-satisfied character. Because, yes, because okay. Steed was always on the edge of that, but not quite crossing over, and I don't like to see Steed.
It's easy for you to see Steed to Steed. Okay, I understand that's a bit visually jarring for you. That didn't happen to me because I guess, much to my shame, I mainly saw Patrick McNee as a kid in The View to a Kill, one of the worst Bond films of all time, which I have a peculiar fondness for because I like the Roger Moore Bond and I know everyone else likes Sean Connery. I love Sean Connery in many other films. I don't particularly like his Bond. I don't particularly like Bond anyway, but anyway, that's another story. I don't think Bond will be troubling Ribbon of Memes anytime soon. Not if I have anything to do with it. Maybe Dr. No at some point. Anyway, that's by the by.
But anyway,
I'm not proposing we do View to a Kill on Ribbon of
Memes. She goes to the phone box where he said he's going to call, and obviously the wire fails because the wire always fails.
Because of all the neon. This is my physics question. Do neon lights interfere?
It's a shorthand. It's not the neon itself. It's the transformers that are producing the high voltage to keep the neon ionized.
Oh, okay.
Which produce a lot of electrical noise.
Okay. All right. So that was plausible.
Because it's a one-way wire, so she doesn't know that they don't know where she is or where she's being told to go or any of that stuff.
Yes, she goes in through into a sex shop, into a...
Oh, the glory days of porn when you had to go and get it in person.
They go in a sex room thing.
Basically it's a private booth and you put your coin in the slot and the film starts up.
I would not want to clean those booths afterwards. Presumably that's what they're for. Anyway, he's in there. He won't let you look at... By he, I mean the serial killer, Eddie, presumed serial killer. He's called the mutilator of somewhere or other, isn't he?
I don't think it's explicitly stated, but it seems pretty clear to me that this is a known, he has killed before, he's going to kill again, and this is their chance to stop him because he's got fixated on Karen.
And he says something like, the others didn't count, they weren't real people, and you are. But then she turns him round, and we all know it's a werewolf movie, and his voice has dropped like several octaves, so it's clearly wolfed out, but we never see that. It's not explicit.
Also because this is not a video screen, as apparently happens these days. It's a mini cinema. So she turns round, she's turning away from the screen, and she's basically looking up into the projector, and just his silhouette is vaguely visible below it.
Yes. And then the police run in, shoot.
Having finally worked out where
she is. Where she is, shoot through the door. And again, it is explicitly stated, quick draw McGraw here, fired too quickly. But that strikes me as quite dangerous. They don't even know what door it is, I think. They could just hear a...
Yeah, we see at least three or four doors in a row.
Yeah.
And I don't suppose they have the thickest of walls between them.
No. Anyway... As luck would have it, he fails to hit Karen with a stray bullet and kills Eddie, the serial killer. Or does she? Does he? Anyway, he gets carted off. She's traumatised, having very bad dreams about what she's seen.
Also, immediately, she has become amnesiac from basically going into the booth to now.
Yes.
Which I believe is a thing that can happen, at least.
High emotional state. Also, it's very dark, confusing lights. You can understand quite why she doesn't really know what happened in there. She freezes up on screen. She can't work. Her husband, Bill, is initially sort of a sympathetic character, I guess, in that he's sort of understanding. He's trying to help her. They are organised to go to a retreat organised by Dr. McNee.
It appears that he basically owns this space.
Which is somewhere on the coast, upstate New York, presumably. And it's a sort of a, it's never quite explicitly stated what it is.
It's a bit of a drive from the city, but we really know.
Probably not more than an hour or two, given what happens later, I guess, but anyway, it's certainly out in the sticks on the coast. It's sort of a commune or experimental community or something.
Or something, yeah. Again, yeah, that in another film there would be a whole scene establishing, as when we talked about Midsommar, you know, the happy, friendly, you arrive at the commune and find out how it works. That scene is simply missing here. We cut straight from, I hope these people aren't too weird, to banjo music.
Yeah, exactly. We have John, the great John Carradine, howling at the moon. I mean, one of the joys for me of this film is just recognizing all the different people in it. We have John Carradine turning up.
Sheriff Slim Pickens.
Sheriff, oh my God. It's so good. We have, well, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the other characters later, but Dick Miller crops up in a later film as well, in a later scene as well. But yeah, it's a commune full of crazy people who like their meat. We have the completely brazen nymphomaniac character Marcia, played. I mean, I can see why Elizabeth Brooks was kind of a bit of a hit from this, but she's not the most. I don't know. She's not the finest actress.
She doesn't have much range necessarily, but the character doesn't need much range. So
no, I think that's fair to say. She's very interested in Bill straight away.
And absolutely blatant about it. I was getting a certain amount of 70s swingers vibe here as well.
I take your point. Now, by this point in the film, I think you are already a bit turned off by it. Is that fair to say?
Basically, that intro sequence struck me as so very much it's 70s, it's tawdry, particularly everything sexual is vaguely tawdry. Look, we can show tits now, we can show part of this violent porn film because it's part of the plot. No, really it is.
Okay. And that
put me in a negative mood to the rest of the thing, which I think in retrospect is not entirely justified.
It's definitely got kind of a Dirty Harry, that kind of style of seedy, horrible. For me, what that did was set up a sense of dread and menace, which worked for the rest of the film. It worked for me. I thought it was an interesting setup that she was, she was trying to find this serial killer, and I was into the setup. I was interested in the characters. I knew this was obviously going to be a commune of werewolves, and it's quite. If you know
the
it's
title
a werewolf
is a bit
film,
of giveaway,
yeah, exactly. Then it's pretty clear they probably are all werewolves. So we get a brief introduction to some of the even weirder characters amongst the weird characters, and some of the ones that seem vaguely friendly, like Sheriff Slim Pickens. Again, can't remember his actual name because he's always going to be Sheriff Slim Pickens.
Is it Donna who is? A fan of Karen's, clearly slightly too much of a fan, but compared with the other people, she's relatively normal.
Yes, yeah, so we have the comparatively normal community.
And the doc is there as well.
And the doc, Doc McNee. I found this really, I was expecting The Howling to just be a pretty, I don't know, kind of an updated version of the Wolfman, just all with tits and blood instead of them. And I found it an interesting setup. And then we have this whole colony of werewolves. So I was interested in it. The women aren't best served in this film. I mean, they certainly weren't in the 40s film. Though at least they were characters in Cat People. They weren't really in the Wolfman. Here, there are different women with different aspects. I mean, I don't know if it's going to pass the Bechdel test, because I don't think anyone talks about anyone other than their men, possibly. But we have, you know, this subplot of the, so while they're up at the commune, we have the other, their colleagues. So he's like is he a producer or an editor? And his reporter girlfriend, who are still at home. Was that Chris and Terry, maybe?
Yeah.
But they have quite a nice, warm relationship. I enjoyed the kind of relationship that they had.
And,
you know,
and
when
the first time we see them, they have just found the place where that appears to have been where the killer was living. And so apparently they don't really care about saving the scene for the police, and the police probably don't care because they have, after all, shot the guy already. So who cares?
about halfway through the scene, they're like, "Should we call the police?" I was like, "Hang on, isn't there a crime scene? What are they?" Anyway, if the police then go there and find their fingerprints all over the place,
they're basically going in and looking for. As it turns out, though, it's only revealed fully later on, that the station is planning to do a feature on this killer and their killing once Karen is up to giving her account of what happened as the showpiece of it.
I suppose you could somewhat generously read it that there's been some leaning on the police that the reporters actually, it isn't going to matter. You've already got the killer. Let us get the story.
Also, maybe your wire screwed up and put her in danger.
So maybe there's been that behind the scenes, but it's not explicitly stated, yeah. And they are doing their best to wreck the crime scene
anyway, and we get a dog jump scare.
Yes, yeah, that's a good dog jump scare, but it also strengthens our female, you know, Terry doesn't just run away and scream, she bats it off with a, I think a dog skull, but I would have been more scared than her, but she doesn't jump and scream or run or anything, so that was nice.
Meanwhile, at the, let's call it a commune.
Yes.
It feels that way.
I think it's literally called the colony, isn't it? But yeah,
the colony. Yeah. Yeah. So, let's see. I think it's there's the nighttime, there are weird noises out in the woods.
Mm.
And Karen, who's obviously a bit more on edge than Bill, sees something, maybe.
Yes, possibly. Now,
my feeling is that if you are in a... It's basically, presumably several cabins. We never actually see a long shot of the colony, but...
It doesn't really establish sense of place very well in that you're basically either lost in the woods or in a cabin, and I'm not sure how far away everyone is from everything.
But if you are in a cabin where the forest is starting just outside your window and you think there is possibly something scary out there, you might potentially close your window.
yes.
Now, then I thought, well, hang on, this is the States, which most of which is far too hot for human habitation. But,
possibly not New York State.
But slightly later on, she's tightening a shawl round her shoulders, which suggests that it is quite chilly out. So,
yeah, fair enough.
I mean, all right, it's a minor thing, but they could have just had her closing the window.
I
wouldn't have heard anything.
Well, it might have built a sense of menace as well. Yeah, so I agree. That's fair enough. Now, what triggers them to go on a hunt? Do they find a dead... I think they're walking on the beach and they find a deer has been killed by some wild animal.
Yeah.
And so the men decide to go on a hunt.
Yeah.
Again, hunting, much as in The Wolfman, you know, at least they're doing it in the day this time, but probably don't wander off on your own when all your mates have got guns nearby.
I mean, this is, to be fair, before Blaze Orange Hunters became the universal thing. Which it really is now. Even then, people get shot a whole lot.
Yes, exactly, yes. If you're looking for things stalking through the Wundergrowth, and your friends are stalking through the Wundergrowth, and you've all got guns, I can't imagine anything would go wrong there. Anyway, Bill, poor old Bill, who up until this point has been, I think, quite a sympathetic character. He's been understanding, caring.
Well, let's see, he goes to Marcia to get something...
He goes to her cabin... Oh,
because
wait, hasn't he been
something.
Bitten? Hasn't he been bitten at this point? Oh, no. He goes there. I can't... There are some points in this film,
yeah. So when he puts off Marsha the first time, on the way back to his cabin, he is scratched by a creature.
It is a werewolf, but yes, a creature. And then he goes to Marsha's cabin.
Mm-hmm. Because she's apparently the person on the site who can bind things up.
She tries again. He resists her, but perhaps not as well as he could do. And then he heads back home. From this point, Bill is kind of written off as a sympathetic character. He's just there's not really a subtle
There is a specific scene later, but I think the way one could read this is he knows he doesn't have to be performatively turning down Marcia because his wife isn't there to watch him. But on the other hand, he still actually does want to be faithful to his wife.
Yes, yeah.
At so this there's point.
I do think there's a slightly unfair scene. So
there's also a thing we'll come back to, which I think possibly justifies this.
There's a scene in the bed earlier on in the film where he tries to initiate sex and she's like, I'm just not ready. And he's like, okay, that's fine. And then later on in the film, she tries to initiate sex. And she looks a bit frustrated when he turns her down. I mean, it wasn't my mind. He had literally just been attacked by a wolf. I mean, maybe he's not in the best mood to, because his leg's full of lidocaine or whatever. I think she was perhaps being a bit harsh on him there, but okay.
So this progresses and eventually he sneaks out in the middle of the night to go and screw Marcia.
That is a very tastefully done porn scene. I mean, how did you feel about it?
Well, other than the final shot, which is just blatant animation.
Oh yeah, yeah, that is that's a shame.
Against the fire. Other than
maybe that was less
I thought it went reasonably
Hyder.
Well by saying, you know, this is not just the local nymphomaniac. This is a bit wild, a bit scratchy.
Yeah, I quite like that.
Even before they start transforming explicitly.
It's doing the explicit kind of, you know, the beast within, as they lose control sexually, then they are losing control of their human form as well. So the animation scene, I don't know if that worked better back in the day when things were a bit fuzzier, but yeah, it's quite clearly drawn as a wolf.
The thing that I think possibly justifies the earlier, activity is if the bite is gradually having its influence on him, because you know, by the time they're actually screwing, he is certainly transforming.
Yes.
So the first time he meets Marcia, he hasn't yet been bitten, and so he just says no, not interested.
Yes.
But yeah, politely, obviously. When he goes to her cabin, he has been bitten, and I think it's starting to have an effect. So possibly that slows him down slightly, and he's I am interested, but no, I'm married, so I'll
yes.
go away now.
And now he's full blown.
Yeah. So you could regard it as the progress of the lycanthropy gradually releasing those inhibitions.
I also, when I say tastefully, that I suppose I mean. It doesn't feel, you may well argue, it doesn't feel gratuitous to me. It feels like an important scene. I mean, it could have been less explicit, I suppose, but it feels
scene. There's that feeling of, well, we've already got our rating because of the breasts we showed earlier. We might as well show more breasts now.
That's fair, but I do think narratively...
I mean, they've got nice breasts, but...
there you are, I'm not complaining. I do feel, you know, a lot of werewolf stories about, you know, repressed sexuality, and I feel that's, I feel like I'm trying to justify porn here, but I do feel it's a useful scene to have that as they lose control, then they transform into these wolves, and it makes it explicit this is kind of a metaphor for the beast within and that sort of thing. I didn't think it was gratuitous.
Dropping the restraints of society, civilization, whatever you want to look at it.
Yeah, and made clear by that final, unfortunately animated, but that final scene of them basically rutting like wolves with him howling up.
Surely
at
if
the
they
moon.
Were rutting like wolves, they would both be belly to the ground. But...
Well, I thought it did cross my mind. Wouldn't there be a great point if they suddenly changed positions and do it doggy style? But it didn't happen. But there we go. I thought that would have been a nice touch.
Meanwhile,
but...
Karen gets one of the most blatant dolly zooms I've seen for years in the therapy session.
Fair enough. Yes, I like a dolly zoom, but I guess they are a bit overused.
So let's see. I think at this point Terry has been called up to the colony. After the bite, Karen gave her a call.
Yes. Well, they have been to, we get the scene, so they go to the occult bookshop and we get the scene with the lovely, I always forget his name, but he's incredibly recognisable. Dick Miller is who I'm thinking of, the Terminator, he just what you see pal guy. He then does the thing that all werewolf films have to do at some point, which is, here are the rules of werewolves for this film. And so he gets the explicit kind of, oh no, in this film, werewolves can turn into werewolves whenever they like. All that moon stuff is nonsense. And silver bullets are the only thing that can kill them. They can come back from the dead.
Also, coincidentally, here on the counter are some silver bullets that some guy bought and never paid for.
That was a very explicit bit of play. But, you know,
I can't resist. Roger's Firearms Corner.
Silver bullets not very good.
There's
a reason you don't make bullets out of silver, I guess.
Well, there are several reasons, one of which is that it's very expensive. But, yeah, there are... If you want to make a solid silver bullet compared with lead, it has a much higher melting point. So, basically, there are standard kits you can buy, particularly in the States, for moulding your own bullets. This is a perfectly normal thing to do. Usually what you would do is use some brass of the same sort of round that had been previously fired, because that's actually quite hard to machine for yourself.
Right.
But you can reuse that if it's not too damaged by the firing, and usually it isn't. And then you mould a new bullet, you pour in the powder, you went the bullet into it. But A, you need a higher melting point furnace. B, you need a mould that can take the higher temperature. But also C, it is soft enough that you get quite serious fouling. I mean, so is lead. Which is why, one of the reasons why a black powder weapon has to basically be cleaned after each time you fired it.
Right.
Also the very corrosive black powder residue. Modern bullets tend to have some sort of jacketing on them so that you have a harder thing that engages with the rifling and doesn't leave residue behind.
I see. Okay.
So probably your actual best bet is to use a jacketed hollow point design. So you have a steel or copper jacket on the outside that, engages with the rifling, gets the spin, leaves the low residue, and then when it hits, the silver payload inside deforms and enlarges the wound cavity. The only technical difficulty with this is if your werewolves are enemy combatants under the Geneva Convention, it is not legal to use hollow points on them.
They're not explicitly excluded from the Geneva Convention, as far as I'm aware.
I mean, as long as they are enemy soldiers in uniform.
Are they in uniform?
This has been Roger's Firearms Corner. You can go down way more rabbit holes than this. There are people with more money than sense who have actually made silver bullets and then tried them out to see how well they work. And it's a reasonably dense metal. It's not as dense as lead, but it will basically do about as much damage as a lead bullet at any reasonable range. But it does have these other... Anyway.
That doesn't matter here. Very helpful to know.
Because they're sitting there on the counter being shiny.
And they'll never be used, obviously. They're just a throwaway comment.
Yeah, I did want to mention the guy who is looking through stuff and not buying, who gets shooed away to introduce this scene, is Forrest J. Ackerman, one of the great early fans. He made fandom into his personality.
Well, apparently...
In both good and bad ways.
Well, many of the members of the colony have names that are directors of werewolf films. I am not well versed enough in werewolf lore to do that, but the film is full of things like Terry and Chris in bed. They're watching The Wolfman,
mm-hmm.
So we get the explicit Claude Rains scene where he's doing the discussion. But then the problem is we just watched The Wolfman for our last episode, and within 2 minutes the film has flipped an hour or so forward to the scene with our cinematic gypsy, again no relation to actual Romas, but it took me out of the film because I knew that.
to be fair, in 1981 this would not be a thing that most people would have the ability to do.
Yes, so it might have worked. And I had literally just watched it. But I like their relationship.
Sorry, I just want to mention in the context of Ackerman, the other cameo, the guy waiting for the phone booth at the beginning after Karen has received her phone call from the killer.
Yes.
Is Roger Corman.
Oh, lovely. Very good.
Now that's the sort of cameo I like, you know. If you recognise the guy, you say, aha, it's him, great. And if you don't recognise the guy, then, well, that's fine. You don't need to.
It's not sure. Yes, that's the problem with the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the later Alan Moore. I just became all about, here is this literary character, aren't I clever? And I love Alan Moore, but sometimes he's a bit too impressed with his own cleverness, I think. Anyway, that's an aside.
So we may get these things slightly out of order. The order is not entirely critical.
It is a slightly confusing film in that people seem to turn up at different places. I think partially because the I'm not really aware of the geography of the colony or where it is in relation to the city or quite the, yeah, that might be why you mix things up a bit.
Yeah. You, as you say, you, in the outside shots, you, well, you could be inside a cabin, you could be outside a cabin on the stairs, or you can be in the woods with nothing else inside. And there isn't really anything. They don't reuse the same shots to say, well, I feel that they would probably be paths. Even if they weren't originally, they would be paths by the time people started using them.
And how close are these cabins together? It would have been helpful, like the main cabin where the doctor is. It's just when people are running from where it'd be nice to know, okay, how far have they got? What is the centre? Are they just, have they got miles to run? Is it just a few hundred yards? A bit more of centre place I would have appreciated.
But, so let's see. Karen objects to the scratches on Bill's side from the wild werewolf sex of the previous night.
He tries to pass it off as, oh, it was probably when that wolf bit me, and she's not having any of it.
Yeah, and then he loses everybody's sympathy, or at least mine, by hitting her because she's being hysterical.
And then immediately
it's more of a slap than a punch, but frankly the distinction is only a matter for your orthodontist.
It's pretty brutal, and then he tries to do the kind of classic, oh, I'm sorry, and she again, wins some respect by telling him to fuck off in no uncertain terms. But at this point, Bill, as the character we sort of had some sympathy with, is gone, and he's not actually in the film very much after that. Well, I think one of the problems with the film is it jumps between the protagonists a bit, and it's not quite sure who's perspective we're seeing it from, and because I'm not sure where everything is, I do get confused. Not between the characters, they're all more distinct, but who is where and why is a little woolly, I found. But she's been spooked, partly, but she's terrified of Bill, but also she's worried about what's going on. Has she been attacked at this point? I don't think she has, but she calls Terry and Chris to get them to come up.
Well, first of all, she calls Terry up, and Terry does some investigation. And I can sort of see this, because Bill is gradually going down the werewolf path. He's not going to be looking into things. Karen is, I mean, it's not explicitly mentioned, but it becomes pretty clear that this is not some weird supernatural thing because of the serial killer. She has been genuinely traumatised. She's not going to be going out exploring stuff.
And she, as you rightly pointed out, she's a news anchor. She's not a reporter.
So Terry goes out and looks into things, and she spots stuff like one of the sketches that they found in Eddie the serial killer's apartment is an exact match to one of the coves.
Coast. She sort of ends up at Eddie's cabin. And,
oh, the torches of the pre-LED era! I remember them so well. I'm so glad we don't have to use them anymore.
They were awful, weren't they? Yeah, I have to say, my phone is better than any torch we had in the 80s.
Then she eventually, well, she makes a panicky phone call to, who is it, Terry. Chris?
She's Terry, yes, he's Chris, yes, sorry. Yeah. Yes.
So she makes a panicky phone call to him saying, basically, that serial killer guy is clearly connected with this place. You've got to get up here. And then it turns out that serial killer guy is very connected to this. Oh, no, sorry. She's gone to Marsha's cabin.
Yeah, I don't quite know why. We have, we've also missed a section where we have I love the
It does get a bit out of order in my head, and I apologise for that.
But what we have learned is that Eddie has broken out of his,
morgue.
Out of the morgue. I love the mortician guy there. I think he was a famous person himself, but he's just so laconic. And I love the little dialogue where he's like, oh, no, it doesn't bother me. Oh, the one who spooked me was my colleague who drowned. just a lovely bit of dialogue, kind of gallows, not quite gallows humour, but it is exactly, in my experience of people who work in such places, that is exactly the attitude they have to this sort of thing.
Which suggests that maybe the scriptwriters did a little bit of research, perhaps, which is always nice.
Or at least they understand human nature enough that they could infer that. Anyway, I like that. But Eddie's not in the morgue anymore.
Eddie is, in fact, in Marsha's cabin because he's her brother.
Yes. And that was clear, I think, yes. But we already know from the info dump from Dick Miller that if you shoot a werewolf, it'll look dead, but it's not dead. And it'll come back. Unless you use a silver bullet. And there happen to be some silver bullets here on the table. Anyway, she is investigating Eddie's cabin. She's investigating Marsha's cabin and finds all the same kind of artwork in the cabin. So she knows Eddie is from there.
She is then attacked by Eddie, brackets werewolf. Did you notice who was playing Eddie?
No, who was playing Eddie?
A first film role for Robert Picardo.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Goodness me. That, I would not... That, you mean the hologram from Deep Space Nine? The emergency medical hologram? Yeah. Shut up. They
and
are not
and
the
a
same
whole bunch
person.
Of cheap Sci-Fi Channel stuff.
Oh my god, I would not have recognised him in a million years.
He's not very recognisable, but that does appear to be him, yeah.
I mean, he's mostly in the dark, or dead, or a werewolf, to be fair, so you don't get a good look at his face.
So Terry is attacked there, she gets away.
Cuts his arm off with an axe.
Yep.
No, that... Wait! Yeah,
yes. Hand, at least.
Yes, okay.
And it keeps wriggling around way longer than it really ought to.
And then we get a glimpse of the nice special effects, because it wriggles around long enough. She doesn't stay and watch, but we gradually see it begin to assume the shape of a human hand, which is, again, we know that's going to happen, but I thought the effect worked quite well.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the effects here seem to involve putting balloons under latex and inflating them and deflating them, but it works quite well. I was quite impressed.
Let's not forget, and this is one of the things that was very much praised at the time. This was some of the best, particularly transformation effects that had been seen.
Yeah, this was, is it Rick Baker who went on to do some stuff with The Thing later on?
No, Rick Baker is, we'll talk about later.
Spoiler. It's Rick Baker's apprentice, Rob Bottin? Rick Baker was the original effects artist.
Rob Bottin, yeah. Rick Baker was the original effect artist, but he left to work on some other film.
Some other film that we may discuss later.
And so he basically handed it over to Bottin, and Bottin finished it off. And particularly, as you say, the air bladders under latex. So that something could change shape well beyond what flesh could be expected to. But anyway, she's attacked, she gets away, she makes the panicky phone call to Chris.
Basically, come and get me, leaves the phone dangling.
And because at that point it turns, I think she's discovered also that yeah, anyway. And then it turns out, no, Eddie's in the room with her.
And then we have this transformation sequence, and it's really long. But yes.
To some extent, I think that's the point of it. It's to say, yes. Look, we can do this now. We don't have to do the stop motion gluing the hair on.
Well, I get the impression that Eddie is kind of reveling in it. He's enjoying the pain, and he's kind of, oh, look at me, man. So he can't really act under all that stuff, but we know he's this kind of sadist, and maybe he's also a bit of a masochist too. And it is just, I was expecting, because I always thought American Werewolf in London transformation scene was the finest one in cinema. And so I was kind of blown away by this one. I don't think it is. We'll talk about it later. But it's just, it is really graphic. And in the same way that the Thing special effects work, it's just kind of, we can do this on foot. We don't have to do the suggestion like we did in Cat People. We're going to ignore all that. We're going to show you everything that happens. Isn't it horrible? And it is. It worked very well for me. It didn't feel like a long, dragged-out scene because I feel like he's enjoying... I did think at some point that Terry should have thought, okay, well, he's standing there doing... He's going to be doing that a while. Can't I just kick him in the balls and run off while he's doing that? But no, she stands there.
She is in the process of failing several sanity checks in quick succession.
fair enough. So we have this incredible, I thought, transformation scene in the style of... The
let's
kind
face
of
it, face... This is the glory days of this kind of latex prosthetic work.
Well, I was going to say, we both...
The Last Starfighter will come along in 1984 and it's all downhill from there.
I like the Last Starfighter.
Yes, but after that, there's CGI.
I guess The Abyss was probably the first film. Oh, no, maybe Terminator 2. Anyway, we are both fond of this kind of special effects work. And so I wasn't expecting it to be quite so I'm not at all surprised to have Rick Baker involved in some way, even though it was his apprentice. It's great. And it goes on a long time. But as you say, I think that's the point of the transformation. It's kind of all bones cracking and lengthening.
I mean, presumably also it goes straight onto Rob Bottin's showreel for saying, you know, I did this and here's how much they paid me. I can do it for your film if you pay me slightly more.
She's got a vial of acid or something. What has she got?
She snatches it up because that's the sort of thing you have in a medical examination room.
Yeah. I wasn't. Maybe if they were analysing urinary catecholamines, they needed to acidify the urine. Anyway, there is a bottle of some kind.
Well, he's not a very good doctor, to be fair.
No, that's also true. Maybe it's not acid. Maybe I wondered if it was like holy water or something. But no one had ever mentioned holy water before.
I think it is just meant to be conventional acid. Yeah.
It has the effect of acid on him anyway, which is basically to upset him quite a lot. And I thought she was going to get away again. You know, she's been in difficult situations. She's not been just a kind of scream queen. She's used her initiative and escaped. Then I do agree with it. I think you felt a bit uncomfortable that it dwells on her suffering.
There's an awful lot of Terry being frozen in fear. Yeah. as the creature gets closer to her. And I certainly got a bit uncomfortable there.
Yeah, I think there is this kind of voyeuristic moment. But then she's sort of quietly killed in a slightly horrific way. He just sort of lifts her up and strangles her instead of ripping her to shreds like a lot of werewolf things. But at this point on, the werewolves are quite explicitly out there.
Well, he is, after all, a weirdo serial killer, not just a werewolf.
Oh, he is, yeah. I think that works quite well, that actually his human side is pretty awful as well as his beast side. And then Chris is on his way now. He's thwarted by the traffic in New York, but he's on his way. He's grabs the silver bullets, keep the change or whatever. No, bill me. And he's off. So
which conveniently fit the rifle he has.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. Did they?
I mean, probably there's some sort of standard with just a load or something of that nature.
Okay. But it's a bolt action kind of rifle.
Yeah, it's a standard hunting rifle.
Meanwhile, we jump back to the story that had been kind of left hanging, like Bill is basically not in the film anymore. And another slightly confusing, thing about this film is the werewolves all look the same and we don't see them all transform. So it is sometimes hard to tell which werewolf are this supposed to be because there's a lot of werewolves. Sometimes I find that a bit confusing. But we're back with Karen now, who is kind of the sole surviving protagonist, apart from Chris, who's stuck in traffic.
Bill is now one of them, clearly.
Yeah. Again, he's not really... Much like with Midsommar... We also had another similarity with Midsommar. We have one of the characters wanting to kill themselves, but much earlier on, tried by jumping off a rock. But anyway, I mean, it's a much better film than Midsommar, for my money.
Oh, come on, John Carradine jumps off a rock. The rock wouldn't dare drop him.
He's probably be too drunk to notice. Sorry, that's a terrible thing to say. He's an excellent character actor, and I want to see more of him. So, again, we're getting hazy on the details because it is a bit confusing, but she somehow ends up in the doctor's office. And I'm not quite sure why she goes in there. She's looking for the doctor, I think.
At this point, she is thinking, Eddie the serial killer is here. I've got to tell the authorities. And the authorities is the leader of the colony, which is the doctor.
Right, yes. But rather than the doctor, she finds the corpse of Tracy.
Terry.
Terry, sorry. And is a bit upset. So she nips out to escape. No car in this film starts first time. They've all got flooded radiators or something like that, because anytime anyone tries to start a car, it doesn't. They're all driven by plot necessity rather than any kind of starter motor. But she then is taken by the werewolves, who take her to a big barn to explain
Chris
the
arrives
plot
at about the same time.
And I quite like that. I like that, the Dr. McNee. There's an internal politics here that he is a bit like the role-playing game Vampire the Masquerade. There's clearly a cadre led by the Doctor who want to be go under the radar. They're worried if they're exposed that they're tough, but they're not that tough. And so they need to live in human society. And there's another cadre led by Marsha, I think. It's basically like,
she's at least the spokesperson for it.
Yeah, we're werewolves. Let's eat people. Yeah,
we are the superior race. Let's go wild.
I don't know if it's sort of implied that these werewolves have lived a long time, but it's kind of suggested that, but maybe I'm misreading
it. It's suggested, but it's not explicit.
But maybe they're just referring to our traditions go back a long way rather than we ourselves have lived for hundreds of years. But I like that kind of tension between them. We never get to see a Patrick McNee wolf, which is very sad. I'd like to see one. But then Chris turns up, starts popping them off left, right and centre.
Well, that's the thing I really like, because they are clearly in this mindset of, well, you know, we are invulnerable. Nobody's got silver bullets. That would be stupid.
Yeah, who'd have a silver bullet? Turns out Chris does.
And so it takes at least two of them just saying, well, obviously you can't stop me. Bang. Ugh, you did stop me. That's not right.
Think after the first one, they might be getting a bit... But then they may be vulnerable to
finally fire. Dr. McNee.
Oh, yeah, Dr. McNee is
tries to take the gun off him and is shot in turn. But this is not that he didn't take the example of the first two, because as he dies, he says, thank God.
Yeah, you get the impression he's just very slowly trying to get the gun off him, like, please kill me. Then they're locked in the barn. They're potentially all going to burn to death, maybe.
When we say they, we mean the werewolves.
The werewolves are locked in the barn. Somehow they just kind of meekly get pushed into the barn. I wasn't quite sure.
I think they are all already in the barn and possibly having a meeting or something, and then the confrontation is happening at the barn door.
Yes. But so instead of trying to not get locked in, they just sort of shuffle back into the barn,
and Chris and Karen hastily slam and bar the doors, and they can't.
Presumably, that's because they're like, "Holy shit, he has got silver weapons, and we're vulnerable." But anyway, the barn goes up much more quickly than any fire I've managed.
They do spread a lot of petrol around it.
They do a lot. Yeah, it still takes a while for a barn like that to go up, but I imagine anyway. Because they're werewolves, they break out of the barn, or at least some of them do. And I'm not sure, at this point, I've no idea which werewolf is which I suppose is part of
the point. Well, I think all I saw, at least, was one particular shot of, yes, okay, clearly somebody is breaking a hole through the side of the barn.
Yes.
And we don't really know what's gone on there, or how many of them might have made it. But what it vitally provides is a delay.
Yes.
So they can start to get away when the car eventually starts.
Yes, and then they meet evil Sheriff Slim Pickens, who's kind of half-wolf. Why he's wolfed, half-wolfed out to shoot them, I don't know. But we get to see at least a wolfy Sheriff Slim Pickens, which is nice. They defeat him.
You get the dex bonus, but not the strength bonus if you shift halfway, you see.
Oh. Chris, who has clearly put some points into his small weapon fire, is much better shot than the cop. In fact, he's a pretty badass action hero. I would have liked to see a bit more of Karen being a bit more... I don't know. At this point, she is not doing anything other than screaming and trying to shoot...
She has one more job in the film, and that begins now, because during the escape, she gets bitten.
And it turns out she's bitten by Bill. I think she shoots Bill. Mm-hmm. It might be Chris, but I think she does it. And she shoots a werewolf who gets through the back windscreen, maybe. Yeah. And she gets scratched and shoots him, and oh dear, it's Bill. And then they return to the city, and then we have the kind of the big final scene, which is a bit like the network scene. And this is the other section of it is a bit, as you say, it touches on the if it bleeds it leads kind of style of network stuff. And instead of the I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore, we have the anchor literally turning into a werewolf. And then I quite like the reaction shots of, like, because that feels like, oh my God, it's revealed to the world. And then we get the reaction shots of people being like, oh, special effects. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Oh, what they did. No one really believes it for the most part. The odd person does, but, you know, it'll all get explained away and it won't actually reveal anything at all. Presumably, I have no intention of watching The Howling 2 or whatever.
And then in the end, Chris, who has retained the rifle, shoots her.
Yes, Yeah,
that's not quite the end, because there is a bit that is all of a sudden very 80s. That last scene where we have people in a bar watching the reacting to the thing.
Oh, yes, yes.
And one guy says, and I'll have a steak and a burger for the lady. And how would you like the burger? And it's Marsha, and she says, raw, and looks directly at the camera. Or rare, sorry.
But
she clearly liked to say raw.
she does say rare. I think she should have said raw. I was expecting to think this was a deeply rubbish film, partly because you'd watched it first and were less impressed. So I was a bit blown away is the wrong thing, but I was very pleasantly surprised by the interesting plot. I thought I was interested in the. I did find it, as we have touched on in the talk through, a little confusing in a number of places. I don't know if the action was handled all that well. The characters were very 70s. I don't think the women, particularly Karen, were particularly well served by the script. But I was interested. It carried me along. I thought the transformation was mind-blowing. I thought it was very explicit in the kind of the beast within and the sexuality. And I like the kind of dynamic in the werewolf group that you know, they're trying to survive. It's an interesting take on it.
I mean, my immediate reaction at the end of the film was the one I shared with you, and that was a couple of days ago before we recorded this, and I am feeling more positive about it now, and that's why I think it was that early impression of the we're going to be gritty cop, we're going to have the porn cinema, and so on.
Yes,
left an impression on it for me, which clearly wasn't the case for you.
No, I was kind of expecting a more tawdry film. And in a way, I think it was a bit classier than that and less explicit than I was expecting, at least in the nudity. I wouldn't go so far as to call this a masterpiece, however, largely because I feel it's very much eclipsed by the film we're about to talk about. But I do think it's a solid werewolf film. I thoroughly enjoyed it. The reason I've no intention of watching any of the other Howling films is because they're all worse than this, apparently. I don't think I've seen them. But I like the ending as well. I thought that was quite cool. A bit of a dig at Network. Not a dig at Network, but that kind of vibe to it as well.
There have been 7 sequels starting.
Oh, God.
Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, Howling 3, 4, 5, most recently The Howling Reborn in 2011.
Blimey.
I have not seen any of them.
Yes, I've no intention of it. I mean, maybe fun for a So Bad It's Good, but they're probably not So Bad It's Good, they're probably just bad.
Well, Christopher Lee's in the second one. And Sybil Danning.
Well, I mean, you're tempting me, but there may be better Christopher. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe. I'm not that tempted, however. Let's move on to a film just a few months later, 4 months later, John Landis's An American Werewolf in London, written and directed by John Landis.
Yeah, and this I think you'd seen before. It was the one that a lot of people... remembering the early 80s when obviously this sort of thing was not the sort of thing that people who were 12 and 13 were allowed to see. But this was the one that people I knew had seen. Not just boasting, but would actually talk about this thing happens, that thing happens, it's really cool. As opposed to The Howling, which I think most of people hadn't. It's been in my background mind for ages as lots of people like this film.
My history with it is it was, I don't think it was a pirated video. I think it was on the telly and we recorded it on VHS. Consequently, it was one of those few films that we had on VHS that we watched a lot. So to me, I had seen it many, many, many times. I've not seen it for a long time, but it was to the point where it's one of those films that I know so well and could recite bits of it that I struggle to be completely objective with it, but thankfully I've had maybe a 10 or 15 year gap since I watched it and I feel like I can be objective again. about it. So let's see how we do. It starts, it feels quite quickly quite different to The Howling. It's much more, it feels much more 80s, would you say, in that the characters in it are straight out of it, but the characters of Jack and David are these American teens, and they just have a much more kind of modern banter, I guess. It does a great job of establishing that they're friends, that they're just nice characters to be with.
It's described as comedy horror, and yes. I guess it is, but it's not the ha-ha sort of comedy. It's this is a silly, slightly silly thing happening, but everybody's taking it seriously sort of comedy.
It does have the line, "Mummy, that naked American man stole my balloons," in it. So I do feel there is some comedy to it.
You know, very, very first shot, we've got this farm truck full of sheep pausing at a signpost, and the driver gets out and lets these two hikers out of the back.
Yes.
Lets them out of the back. Why aren't they in the front? The dog's in the front.
Yes, it's a nice touch. And they are very grateful. And again, we feel at home because they say, you know, I'm from the north. This is a kind of northern, kind of no-nonsense, kind of get on your way, lads, kind of character. And they're like, the sheep shit in my backpack. It's a lot of nice kind of character building quite early on. Then they go to one of my favourite places in all of cinema, the Slaughtered Lamb. I have a t-shirt
The interior is the Black Swan in Cobham, which is not actually that far from me.
Oh, interesting. I'll have to try it out. It has the kind of, it's just that kind of stereotypical, almost League of Gentlemen-esque kind of, they walk in this room full of life and happiness and just everything stops. Like even the dart almost stops on the way to the dartboard. Just as everyone turns to look at them. It has also, it doesn't hurt that it's got like Brian Glover, Rick Mayall, what's his face? The You Made Me Miss, you became a much famous, a more famous actor later on, but it's kind of, Rick Mayall sadly doesn't get much to say in it, but it's nice to see a very young Rick Mayall there.
Yeah, again, he's not particularly recognizable, but if you think about his face, yeah, that's clearly him.
Yes, yeah. And it's just that great kind of fish out of the water feeling. I really love Griffin Dunne here. You know, the kind of the Slaughtered Lamb. He is a great, so he's, Jack, David's friend. And it's just I don't know. I just really like the banter. It's one of those films that I feel I can trust the film at this point because it's established the characters quite well and I'm interested in their plight. It's not too big. I just trust the film at this point. I'm finding it pleasant and funny, but also, it's funny because of the way the character's reacting, not because of the characters are trying to make light of their situation. It's not a kind of ho-ho, this is a comedy.
Yeah, nobody is stopping to do a joke.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Except Brian Glover, of course, with the Alamo joke.
but in any case, there is clearly nothing to be had here. And they are, I think they, at this point they are not actually lost, but they foolishly set off into the night in the hope
they
of getting
kind of sent out into that
somewhere.
I love the kind of you know, there's clearly a Cthulhu, Call of Cthulhu investigation to be done in this village, but they don't do it. There is a vague attempt at it later. But I like the kind of should the whole world know our business, and you know they know exactly what's going on. It's good. I like it.
And indeed, one of the things I like about this is that we cut between the two hikers who have been told very deliberately stay on the road, stay off the moor.
Yeah.
Who immediately leave the road.
Yes.
You don't even see them doing it. I feel
they would, don't even they, know that.
I feel you would notice that, you know, you don't have tarmac under your feet, you have grass, but apparently not.
I think the implication is the roads are so crap, which is not, you know, this isn't...
none of the roads we see is that crap.
No, that's true. I guess the implication is they don't notice, but I agree with you. It seems like a bit of an egregious error.
But anyway, the thing I particularly want to call out here is that as we're cutting between that and the scene back in the pub, there are clearly people in the pub who think, you know, we've just sent these kids off to get completely slaughtered by our local beast. And they're not saying it explicitly because obviously they all know what they're talking about. But they're feeling a bit uncomfortable, and you know, I don't want to go out there and save them.
Yeah,
I guess somebody's going to have to. Oh, all right, I'll do it.
Yeah, without it, it's just built up through the dark. Without it explicitly saying, we better go out and rescue them, because it kind of ends before you see that. But yeah, it's clear that when they do turn up and rescue them, well, one of them, that's why it happens. Mm.
But anyway, so there is something out there howling, and they get attacked.
They aren't any coyotes in England. But
there aren't any wolves in England either, officially, but, you know, that's...
Jack is killed. Jack is attacked.
I think it's quite important that David has just argued with him enough that he's saying, right, well, I'm going off my own way.
Yes, yeah.
And that's when the attack happens, so obviously he comes back to try to rescue Jack.
Well, again, he sort of runs away at first. I mean, whether he could have done anything, pretty unlikely. But then he does turn around.
But in terms of what happens later, he's got that. It's never mentioned again. Jack, slight spoiler here, the Revenant Jack doesn't say, you abandoned me to die.
It's interesting,
but
isn't
it? It's clearly still in his head.
You would think that Jack would be a little pissed off, but maybe he realises. To be honest, if Jack had been there, he probably would have been killed too, because the villagers would have arrived. If David had been there, he probably would have been killed too, because the villagers would have arrived just that bit later in the attack. Anyway, David is attacked, scratched, bitten. He is now a werewolf. We see the wolf thing get shot, and the last thing David sees before he loses consciousness is a man dead on the floor who's been shot, as well as Brian Glover's face, which is, to be honest, I'd be quite happy to pass into consciousness seeing Brian Glover's face. This is my slight query,
yes,
though.
Yes, because he comes back to consciousness seeing Jenny Augusta's face, which is obviously better.
Okay, I was going to say arguably, but no, you're quite right. somehow, from here, and this feels like a bit of an American view of British geography, despite being abandoned somewhere on the Yorkshire Moors, he wakes up in a London hospital, because London is the only hospital, is the only place presumably that can, rather than say Leeds, he ends up in London. I'm not, mm-hmm. We never quite find out how he traverses the 300 or so miles to go to this.
Well, you can drive there and back in a day, as we'll see later.
It's not pre-motorway, is it? But it's not far off. Was it 1981? It wouldn't have been motorways the whole way.
Oh, so
anyway.
I'm missing a chance of Roger's motorway corner here.
I will let you pontificate on motorways if you like.
No, I don't remember the full. I think it's as far as Leeds. And yeah, 1972, the Central Leeds extension opens.
Well, yeah, so the M1 must have been there. I mean,
that's the M1 I'm talking about. So yes, late 60s, it goes up towards Yorkshire. Anyway, it was planned to end at Doncaster, and they went further because turns out
we're not quite sure where we are.
Far geekier corner to come later.
Okay, good. But somehow, that aside, he ends up in London. Maybe it is where expats have to go, American, because he's American. I'm not sure, but I don't think that would have been foremost on their mind when they took him to hospital.
They wouldn't even have known at first.
In a local hospital at first, because it turns out he's been in a coma or at least unconscious for 3 weeks. So maybe he was in
a local hospital. There's something explicit there, because his wounds, by the time the doc sees him, what's his name?
Oh, yes. Again, another character that very recognisable.
John Woodvine, who was in basically everything. I think he was known actually more for his stage career than for his film, because he did a hell of a lot of stage work.
I vaguely remember him from The New Statesman, where he was the slightly gun-obsessed chief of police in it, and was very grateful for Alan Bastard for legalising weapons.
He is the only actual doctor we see. Jenny Augusta is one of the nurses. And again, he's never actually named as a consultant, but I certainly have met, and I imagine you have too, people who absolutely fit his mannerisms, right down to the midlife crisis sports car. Man is a consultant.
Yes, absolutely. And the kind of sense of superiority. Mm-hmm. It's very nicely done. But also I like the kind of hint of cover-up. Somehow he was treated before he got to the hospital.
Yeah, because that's the thing. As far as he is concerned, there had been treatment already. Or, you know, his wounds had been at least bound up a bit, but there was no other doctor listed as having had anything to do with him. So that suggests he did actually come straight to this hospital.
Yes, you're right. Doesn't really work. Which doesn't make sense, but I like the hint of cover up, or maybe he's just already healing super quick because he's a werewolf.
Well, there's that too. I mean, he has a big scar on his cheek, which frankly I would expect to see a dressing of some sort on, but anyway.
It's probably more of a cinematic journey. Anyway, he wakes up to Jenny Agutter, alumnus of Ribbon of Memes, from a few years before.
Yeah, Logan's Run in 76.
Logan's Run. I mean, I was a teenager, but one of the many reasons I watched a lot of American Werewolf in London may have something to do with it having Jenny Agutter in it.
But also she has a lot more to work with here than in Logan's Run, I feel.
She is not only a very good-looking young woman, she is a really good actress, a really good actor as well. There's a lot more sort of emotional resonance here because she's professional. I mean, again, a bit like with Cat People, you get the attraction between them. I know she's crossing a professional boundary, but, you know, it just works that she's been looking after him for weeks. And then he wakes up and he is quite charming and funny and exotic because he's American. And it just, it works quite well and it's clearly frowned upon. She's obviously quite a good nurse. Anyway, David is increasingly having horrific nightmares, loping through the woods, blood, hunting. I mean, it's all, you know.
Dead people.
And then the kind of the weird science fiction kind of Mars Attack style dream where he wakes up at home in his house in America, but it's suddenly invaded by kind of militaristic aliens who kill everyone and slit his throat. And then he does the classic kind of, oh, I woke up. Oh, no, I'm still in a dream. But it doesn't abuse its thing. It all works well for me.
Less well for me. I think actually one of the film's few missteps is the comedy police.
Okay, yeah, I will say, again, I think comedy and drama sit well together, but that is not what everyone universally thinks about American Werewolf, clearly, because you don't think it too, but some of the reviews mention that the comedy and the drama elements don't work that well together.
The sergeant who is, you know, constantly tripping over things or knocking things off shelves or whatever. It just doesn't seem to have a place in this film.
Because he's sort of an Inspector Clouseau character, isn't he?
Because we've already got a role for the Inspector Villiers, which is to say that you were killed by an escaped lunatic. All the evidence points to it. What is this wolf nonsense?
Yes. He's just a funny character. And he's exactly the kind of character you are not a fan of. Am I right? So because he's kind of ho-ho, look at this idiot. And it's too easy to imagine.
Sergeant, yeah, I mean, I feel that the sergeant should have done something other than being a comic butt, because that's all he gets to do in the film.
Yes, he doesn't actually do anything else. Yes, that's fair. Okay, fair. I like it, but I acknowledge its prep.
But anyway, you know, the point of the scene, other than a bit of comic relief, is, you know, this is, we have this narrative, all the evidence backs it up. If you think you were attacked by a wolf, well, you've had a traumatic time. They're not exactly accusing him, but they're clearly not ready to discount everything else pointing towards the escaped lunatic.
But it does...
this guy's account.
But because there's some peculiarities, it does arouse our doctor's suspicions that maybe there is something a bit more going on here. I like that he is a more open-minded character than you might assume from his first appearance. He is prepared to think things through, and he is a bit, probably, you know, just professional interest. Well, there are some unusual things here. It probably isn't a werewolf, but there's something gone on. So to the point where it bothers him enough that he will drive up to Yorkshire to see if he can solve the problem.
Yeah.
Partially for his own intellectual curiosity, I expect, because he is superior to other humans and he's exactly got that kind of manner. But he's a good character regardless.
Meanwhile, Dad Jack turns up.
Yes, Griffin Dunn, with the first of what is some, I don't know. To me, that's some glorious makeup. I mean, it doesn't quite make sense chronologically. Okay, he's been dead 3 weeks, but he looked freshly killed in the first Revenant appearance.
And
but
then over the next 2 days... thoroughly unconvincing green skin.
That's the one that works the least well. Yeah. And then by the third appearance, just a few hours later, I think he's basically a zombie. But still...
He is here to do is explain how werewolves work in this film.
Yes, he's the werewolf.
Which is basically anybody who is killed by a werewolf becomes restless dead.
It's not clear whether
they're actually corporeal or not.
And no one else sees them, but they're not really given the opportunity to. It could just be David hallucinating. But either way, he spells out you are going to become a werewolf at the next full moon. Werewolves tied in the full moon, which happens to be... well, it's nearly a month since the last full moon. It's going
You've
to be
got
tomorrow.
2 days.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be in a couple of days. And what he's also there to do is basically to encourage David to kill himself.
No, it did occur to me, and this is obviously not the film to do that, but it would be really interesting to see a something with the level of ambiguity of Cat People in which one of the possible truths is, yes, you are this creature, you must kill yourself. And the other is, no, you are mentally damaged, you need help.
Yes, and this is suicide.
And showing that as an internal struggle. And, I mean, this is not the film that does that. Fair enough.
No. Well, then we wouldn't get Rick Baker's special effects later on. So I'm not complaining, but I agree. That would be an interesting... Cat People did that brilliantly, I think. And this is a very different take.
Yeah. But Cat People never had, oh, you should kill yourself. It didn't have risking jumping off
I'd
a high
say
place or whatever.
Is he imagining these things, and is it really a form of his own kind of despair?
It is certainly the case that nobody else ever sees dead Jack.
I think the implication, or at least the reading of it, is because everything else pretty upfront, is that they genuinely are ghosts, because otherwise how is he imagining the other victims exactly as they were when he's never met them?
Sure.
But maybe he has some memory of them as a wolf. But... regardless.
What this also does is set up the very explicit and very short timeline, as you say, which, you know, in the other films we've talked about so far, it's generally been, you know, things are gradually getting worse.
Mm.
But in this, it's no. Tomorrow night you might be okay. Night after that, tough.
Yeah, you're going to be a werewolf. It's been nearly a month.
But looking on the bright side, Jenny Agutter takes him home.
I mean, there's worse ways to spend the last 2 days on Earth. It's like she's kind of a modern character. She makes the first move. She's faintly embarrassed to be in this position, but also she's going for it. We have some... Well, it's interesting here, because here we have, David is a real... kind of innocent. He's just a nice guy who's had a terrible thing happen to him. And in this case, there is no, in the other werewolf, pretty much all the other werewolf films we've talked about so far, there's this suggestion of, repressed sexuality and the fear that it will come out as a beast. Here, there's no link between the sex and the wolf. He just has, presumably great sex with Jenny Agutter. But, there's no suggestion that he's turning into a wolf at that point.
Did actually see one summary suggesting that he seduces her by virtue of his already becoming a bit wolfish. And I honestly don't think the film supports that even slightly.
I don't think so. I think, well, it's not what I read into it, but there's no kind of... it's all kind of done through charm and, flirting. That's how it felt to me. It could be, yes. Yeah, I suppose you could
says,
read it.
Oh, there's only one bed, and she says, "Well, yes, that was the plan."
That's the idea. Now, I suppose you could argue the reason she's attracted to him without quite knowing why is because he's a werewolf,
well,
maybe.
Possibly.
But I don't feel like you need
to
understand that.
It's not presented
as
the gross breach of professional ethics that it clearly actually would be. So.
Yes, exactly. And so it's interesting that this film is less interesting, like setting up a metaphor. I don't feel like there's a lot under that. This is basically, this really is just like, this boy has been attacked by a werewolf. He's going to turn into a werewolf because of the full moon. that's a shitty thing, isn't it? But there's no like, and he's, you know, he's repressing this urge to do this, and he always had to. It's just, you know, oh, you've got rabies. Oh, you've got werewolf. You know, you've got lycanthropy. And I find that an interesting, fresh take on it is not trying to. And I don't know if that is the point of the sex scenes or whether it is just because it's 1981 and you can have sex scenes now. And we've got these two young, handsome actors. Let's have them bump uglies. I don't know. But I
can't offhand place David Norton in anything else, but I think he had a feral career.
I think he did. I can't remember seeing him in anything else. Jenny Agutter, of course, we've seen in many other things. She is at, I mean, I think this is one of her best performances. She's just a very...
Of the two I remember, which is this and Logan's Run, absolutely. another thing that works is that this isn't just, you know, she is convenient to the plot, so they will stay together. No, she still has to go to work.
Yes, yes. So she does have to go to work, so David... mooches around the house. And I like that it's kind of, you know, he's been explicitly told you're going to turn into a werewolf. He's looking in the mirror just like, oh, I'm not turning into a werewolf. What is this nonsense? And just not. And then he turns into a werewolf. You know, it just hits him out of the blue. So there's no avoiding it.
Though a thing that struck me having grown up in the 80s was, yeah, I remember that style of television.
Yes, yeah. He tries to watch the TV.
Which is not a sort you see on film very often.
It's pre-Channel 4. Yeah, we have this great advert for, like, a News of the World article. Yeah, I vaguely remember that sort of thing. You just wouldn't see it now. And there's only three channels to watch. And one of them
turned off.
This is
one of the two page three girls who appears in this film.
Yeah. Oh, who's the other one?
Lindsay Drew is in the film later.
Okay. And then we have the famous, and I think largely fated as the greatest cinematic werewolf transformation of all time, which is a bit of a shame for The Howling, because that was fated as the greatest cinema werewolf transformation of all time for about 4 months until Rick Baker basically said, hold my beer, and did another one.
And again, as in The Howling, it is frankly quite long.
It is, yes.
I mean, the point of that is to show off the artistry rather than to say, this is very painful or whatever.
Well, I do think there is a difference in nature. You know, in The Howling, he's enjoying it. He's like showing off his kind of, look at me, look what's going on. I can take this pain, and I'm probably kind of enjoying the pain. David is not doing it in front of anyone. He is in agony and he is terrified. And I think that is really well done. I mean, the scene that always stands up to me is kind of the lengthening of the nose, which again we had in The Howling, but the kind of transformation from a human face to a canine, a lupine face. It's really explicit and quite long. I don't think it's quite as long as The Howling one. It doesn't feel quite as long, but it is, it's just really visceral. And really well done. And then the wolf.
I confess, I didn't at the time think, oh my, this is so much better than The Howling. They're obviously using a similar technological base.
Yes,
we must concede that Rick Baker got the first ever Oscar for best makeup for this scene, for this film.
I think he
would get 6 more Oscars for best makeup.
Quite right, too. So why not best special effects? I suppose it is makeup. Best practical effects. Anyway, I do think it is slightly better. It relies less on balloons going up and down.
But I
think it's arguable either way. But it is a really visceral transformation scene. And I like that what we get afterward, we do explicitly see the wolf creature, and it is... It's basically like a dire wolf, kind of this... unlike the bipedal werewolves in The Howling, which, as you agree, raises all manner of questions about where their hockey is and what they're walking on and what is this kind of... How do they do this on a digitigrade or is it a foot? Here it's just a wolf. It's just a big, horrible wolf. And then we see his killing spree through London. And again, the fact that it is in modern-day London probably helps with us. You know, it's a place we're both...
A lot of this stuff is clearly filmed on location. I think most of the stuff in North is actually filmed in Wales, but there is just that set of yes, I've been to places like this, both while on the moors and while in London.
Yeah, so it helps.
I was living in London at the time this film was being filmed, at the time it came out. So,
well, apparently they actually managed to, later on, when we're in Piccadilly Circus, they actually managed to stop the traffic in Piccadilly Circus, which is usually not explicitly done at all, on the basis of showing the Blues Brothers to all the police, I think.
they also got a quite rare filming permit on the underground, because usually underground stuff is filmed in Aldwych Station, because it was a stub line that you could just close off late at night.
Okay. But this was I did make a note of the underground station, but I forgot what it was.
It's Tottenham Court Road.
There we go, yes.
While the victim is fleeing through the passages, I don't think they quite link up. I did spend a lot of time walking through Tottenham Court Road Station.
So you're more familiar.
It's within the Torrances. Yeah, all right. My geeky thing is Rogers Underground Corner, because, yes, this is the 1972 stock underground train, which was, at this point, starting to look a bit old and ratty. It's only 9 years old, but they did not build them to last, unlike the 1938 stock, which was sometimes even at this point still running.
Okay.
Because it was just great. But yeah, these were the new trains when I was a kid in London.
So it is period appropriate.
Well, obviously it's period appropriate because they were filming it in the period.
Right, yeah,
but
okay.
But to me now, it is really nice to see, yes, this is this specific model of train that is utterly familiar to me.
Oh, yeah, well, it really does help. I've been playing a lot of Atomfall recently, which is basically Fallout set in Cumbria. And just having, it's interesting how much having kind of a British milieu really grounds it to having these are experiences I've had. It really helps to give you a sense of place, as opposed to other games where it's, you know, a fantasy world or the East Coast of America or something. I get a similar feeling here. These are places I've been, and London I'm less familiar with than you, but I am familiar with it, and so it works very well. So we get this series of murders. The accountant slash banker on slash perhaps an unfortunate turn of phrase on the underground. We get the nice middle class couple going for a dinner party somewhere, and we get the trio of tramps on the banks of the Thames, all of whom are murdered by David.
Back in the days when you could get to the bank of the banks of the Thames without paying several hundred quid an hour.
I was going to say, that was the one thing that didn't ring true to me, is that
actually valid for then.
For then, okay, that's all right then. So you could actually just sit on the banks instead.
Remembering this is before all the Docklands development was even thought of.
Okay. So, there we go. It's fascinating to revisit this. David then wakes up in the wolf pen at London Zoo, and I think you said off, you know, that could have been played very comedically, and in some ways it is.
I mean, considering something like A Fish Called Wanda, which does essentially play that as comedic embarrassment.
Yes. I mean, it could also have, on the flip side, it could also have played up the real horror of the situation of, oh crap, I'm in real trouble here. This is why I think it works, the comedy horror. It finds a good middle ground between those. It's not like, you know, a gritty 80s, holy shit, I'm going to get arrested, what am I going to do? But it doesn't just be like, tee-hee, look at this guy. It finds a nice middle ground of the horror of being a wolf and getting clothes. And then he makes it back to the apartment. And then they are, meanwhile,
thinks something has happened to me. I woke up in the zoo.
Yes. Gets back home and then finds out there's been many murders and six murders, and immediately connects the dots. That was me. Whether he actually sort of remembers a bit of it or not, but it doesn't take much convincing that it was him. He's pretty certain it was him straight away. I suspect that's because he's got some dim memory of it, but it's not explicitly stated. Our doctor, our consultant, on hearing of the murders, decides to drive up to Yorkshire at that point. Is that when he heads off up? Yes, I think you're right. I think he's already been curious enough to go up to Yorkshire. and Enter the Slaughtered Lamb and have a similar experience to David and Jack.
But as an older white man with a proper English accent, he can get a bit further.
Yes, exactly. And he uncovers some of the story, not quite, but he's convinced enough to be quite worried that at least he believes that David believes he's a wolf. Which is the go-to in werewolf films that, well, there is such thing as lycanthropy, but it's a disease of the mind, not of the, not a physical disease. But he's worried enough. He's given the cold shoulder by Brian Glover, but finds out from the other villager that there is something happened and there was a cover-up, and he is concerned. And I think, again, to be fair to his character, he is open-minded enough to at least consider the possibility that maybe he does transform into a wolf. So, at this point, David's woken up. He finds out there's been murders. He immediately connects the two. Then the doctor rings the nurse.
Well, he tries to get arrested.
Oh, that's right. That's a scene of trying to get...
What we would now call protective custody.
I think it's much easier to get arrested nowadays, or at least put into protective custody. Certainly in modern day America, I'm sure you wouldn't have to try quite as hard as that. But he is, probably because he is white, and American and not a young black kid, he finds it much harder to get arrested than he would like.
He phones his family in the States, talks to his little sister, says goodbye to them.
Yes.
Tries to kill himself in the phone booth, and I'm not going to have Roger's suicide corner, but
he
makes a mistake that many people make when you're doing that particular thing.
Goes to a porn cinema.
But it doesn't work anyway.
It doesn't work, regardless.
Dead Jack invites him
into a porn cinema.
This is not your high-class individual booths, this is an actual cinema.
This is an actual cinema, yes. It's not I'm not sure. High class in the Howling porn cinema necessarily go together. But then he meets all of his victims in a sort of... I mean, it works. I mean, David's already cropped up in his unconvincing green...
Jack.
And basically reiterated that he had to kill himself again. But in the porn cinema, he meets all his other victims, all of whom are a bit pissed off. They're the freshly dead. Whereas Jack has kind of degenerated and kind of a very nice animatronic zombie thing with bits of flesh. Worked for me when I was a kid, and it's hard to, I think it stands up pretty well now, that kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's an animatronic rather than a mask. I can't see how that would be a mask. And it moves much more like a kind of machine thing than Griffin Dunn had previously moved. But it's well done. His victims are pissed off because now they're all undead. I like the fact that they retain their person, like the middle class couple are both, hello. And the tramps are really pissed off with him. And the accountant, especially, the white collar worker is especially annoyed at his carnivorous lunar activities. It's a nice scene.
And of course, because it's a John Landis film, there has to be a See You Next Wednesday reference. And that is the title of the porn film that is playing.
The porn film is quite funny as well. I mean, it's just like the moment when jury in flagrante delicto, the man bursts in and says, I told you never to do this sort of thing again. And then the man says, no, you didn't. And he says, no, I mean her. And she's like, I've never seen you before in my life. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. And walks. I like the kind of lighthearted nature. It had a sort of carry-on vibe.
That, and the other one is Lindsay Drew. But,
It has a carry-on vibe to it, that kind of seaside, that nails it quite well, if you'll pardon the pun. And then we're basically into the end of the film, because
although David is clearly not happy about this situation, the wolf is now taking over, particularly when the police come in and try to arrest him.
Yes. So he transforms in the cinema, basically murders everyone in the cinema, I think, or those who don't run away very quickly. The police come in to try and get him. Then we get the full-blown werewolf attack in Piccadilly Circus, which is... I don't know, it's a really nice bit of action. Whereas with The Howling, I was a little bit confused as to what was going on here. I don't know. It's just full-blown werewolf chaos in London. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really... How did you feel about that? I thought it was really well done.
And it's a thing that I complain about a lot anyway, but the thing that really works here is, yes, there is still this sense of place, and I'm over here and I'm attacking these people that I'm trying to get to over there.
Yes.
Because that's my way out, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I've hit a bus, and it's just chaos. It's controlled chaos that is totally understandable. Meanwhile, they've heard about this giant wolf. By they, I mean Jenny Agutter and our consultant character, Alex, I think Jenny Agutter's character is called.
And Dr. Hirsch.
They have heard there's a big wolf in Piccadilly Circus, basically. They both, I quite like that they're both like, that's David. You know, there's no kind of, the film doesn't mess around with them kind of doing the Dana Scully thing of, well, could it be? Has this coincidence? Has it escaped? No, they're just like, that's David.
Well, in effect, they know that the entire rest of the world is going to be the skeptic of this.
Yes, and they're the ones that know the truth. They corner him. She pushes away through a police line because he's cornered in an alley nearby Piccadilly Circus as a wolf. And she calls out to him, and I think it's very well done. There's a brief moment of recognition,
mm-hmm.
and then he leaps, and then he's immediately killed by the snipers.
Armed response unit.
Yes, because they don't need silver bullets to finish David off.
We have previously established this, that any sufficiently major damage will get the job done.
Will do the job, which is what happened to the first werewolf. That's where the film ends, with David's body on the floor. So I guess it's, in terms of plot, it's not terribly complex, is it really? I mean, you're going to turn into a wolf. He does turn into a wolf. He gets killed. But everyone,
on the other hand, if you'd said, this is the guy who directed Animal House and the Blues Brothers, and what this film is about is a subtle character study, I don't think he'd have got funded.
True. I mean, it's much less plot dense than The Howling, for instance, or even Cat People, really. It's not really got the psychodrama that is often associated with werewolf films. You know, he's not like angsty. He's like, it's a true tragedy in a way that, like, you know, the bus is coming towards you. Can you get out of the way? No, the bus is going to hit you. That's a tragedy, really. And you want him to avoid it, but there never really has any meaningful chance of avoiding what's coming. So in a way, it's kind of a bit of a grim story, but it is leavened by its sense of humour, by the actors are all really good, from Griffin Dunne, Jenny Agutter, David Norton, Brian Glover.
This is a whole bunch of people who were already having or would go on to have really quite serious careers.
Yeah. It's interesting because I really like it. It's very well done. And I suppose it goes back to, I can't remember if I said it in this episode or the previous episode, in Aliens, I'm not interested in, a lot of the character nuances. These characters are in a desperate situation. I care about them. What are they going to do about it? That worked fine for me for a film. And that's kind of this sort of film as well, that it isn't a lot going on under the surface, I don't think. Or am I missing something?
But I think there is a character study. I mean, the tension here is within David. Is he going to wolf or not, but what is he going to do about it? Does he have any chance of resisting it? That kind of thing. Is he even going to believe it?
But the difference is, this isn't some character flaw that David's already had and he's been punished for it. This is a shitty thing that happened to David.
Mm.
And the way the characters react to it, and the love story works very well for me as well. I just think it's a very well done, it's very cinematic, but it's very well done film. I take your point that there is some character study there and we care about the characters, but
I think it is distinctly better as a result of that.
Yeah. And that's the essence of drama, is make characters you care about and put them through a shitty time. And that works well. That's exactly what happens here. I think it's great. I love it. I liked it a lot as a kid. I was very pleasured. I enjoyed rewatching it this time. I would watch it again tomorrow, and that is a good sign.
Yeah, I don't have your nostalgia for it, but certainly I did very much enjoy it.
Mm. Is it a masterpiece?
I mean, quite possibly.
Mm.
As with my usual, nothing is perfect. Nothing is perfect. There are certainly things that would have worked better done differently. But I think overall, this is definitely in the top rank of films. And I'm surprised I find myself saying that. I did not expect much from it. Possibly that was a good thing. But I didn't expect much from The Howling either. And I think we're both clear that while that gets a lot of things right, it isn't a masterpiece.
Yes, I agree. I think America, I have to filter out my nostalgia factor. Was it influential? I guess it probably was. You know, on the strength of this, Michael Jackson hired John Landis to do Thriller. And that was pretty influential. I think, for me, it's a masterpiece in that it does everything. What it wants to do, it does, and it does really well. To a point where, yeah, you could maybe argue a few things, but you can't imagine it being much better as a film what it is. And I think part
of the trick of filmmaking is realizing that you cannot do everything.
Yes.
And pick the things you can do and do them well.
And that's what it does, exactly. In the same way that Cat People, which we talked about last episode, is a very different take on it. But does those that, you know, there, they were like, okay, we're not going to get great special effects for this. Well, let's just suggest things. That does that incredibly well. Here it's like, no, like balls out. These are werewolves. This is a werewolf. Let's do it. It does that really well as well.
We've got Rick Baker, let's use him.
Exactly. And, you know, if you've got Rick Baker, then you should use him. Absolutely. I'm surprised so far in this werewolf watch through how much I'm enjoying these werewolf films. The only one, hand on heart, I didn't massively enjoy, and that's not really true either, I did enjoy it, is The Wolfman. I still would watch that again because I enjoyed it enough. And because it's exactly the sort of film I like anyway. So I have to say all four of these films have, so far, we're going to watch some more, but all four of these films so far have a lot going for them in a way that I appreciate it. You know, we just talked about Near Dark and The Lost Boys, both of which I enjoyed. Lost Boys I'm similarly nostalgic for. But I have to say, frankly, I enjoyed those films less than I've enjoyed, I think, any of these. Like they've all been very, very enjoyable.
Even though they're doing less in terms of changing around the lore than the vampire films did.
Well, that's in a way what I'm surprised at. They're often quite conventional werewolf films. Like the one that's least conventional in a way is The Howling, just because it's a... Well, no, Cat People is probably the least conventional because it's a cat.
But all of them have the basic, I mean, you could argue that this is the core fear behind it of you have got a disease, you are going to turn into a ravening beast.
I think that's, that you're going to lose control of your...
It's always the same.
Yeah. Fair. I'm very much enjoying them. We will watch a few more, possibly after a break, possibly not. We'll see how we feel, but we're going to come right up to date. Well, no, what I think of up to date is about 15 years ago. but we're going to come...
We shall see some more recent ones, yeah.
Into the new millennium with some more werewolf films. Well done, Rick Baker. One to watch, I think.
Yeah, he when he retired, he basically said... More or less, for the last few years, it hasn't been so much fun because everybody wants quick and cheap CGI, and nobody has the patience for practicals anymore.
I think that's the right. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with CGI. It's just exactly used as that. It's quick and cheap. It's cheaper than we could do this way around, and we have to put less thought into it. Well, I mean, some CGI is incredible, but
in the filming of 2010 Odyssey 2. I remember a documentary about this that came out at the time. There is one particular scene where they're doing a zero-G transfer between two spacecraft. And this cost a certain number of millions of dollars to film. Hiring a space shuttle flight would have cost only twice as much.
Oh, God.
So you can see the reason for trying to go for cheap.
You can understand the appeal. And I think people have got better at using CGI more subtly, to the point where, you know, the ones you don't notice are the best ones, aren't they? You're not like, oh, that's CGI. But I think it's usually, I guess we would say this, but I, It's better when it augments practical effects rather than when it replaces them.
Yeah, but we will doubtless rant about this again in the future.
Yes. Anyway, there we go. More werewolves. We will talk more anon.